So I was looking back at past Father's Day sermons I've done this past week, thinking surely I've done several sermons about this day that we celebrate today. I mean, after all, each year I do tell the story of Mother's Day, right? And how it sprang from the work of some visionary women who wanted to honor their mothers for the work they were doing in bringing a sense of peace and unity into the world through their work in mending fences after the horrors of the Civil War. And each year we explore Julia Ward Howe's famous Mother's Day proclamation, and we hear the story of Anna Jarvis and her daughter, especially Anna Rees Jarvis, who truly stands as the founder of Mother's Day, and how after fighting so hard for the day, she actually fought equally hard against the day when it became one of flowers and chocolates rather than the work of peace that she wanted to honor her mother for. It's a fascinating story. So surely, I thought, I'd also recounted an equally fascinating tale of the advent of Father's Day, right? As I quickly learned in perusing my sermon files to go back almost 7 years, no, I had not. I never addressed Father's Day in a sermon. So today is your lucky day. You've won the Father's Day lottery. So I sat down, as I usually do, with my coffee to begin my lofty and deep dive and research into the history of this day that we celebrate today, and sure that I was going to find an equally engrossing and engaging story full of heroic characters like Mother's Day and powerful events and a long march and winding history to get to where we are on this third Sunday in June. I went to my trusted sources. I shouldn't reveal them, but I'm going to. History.com, Wikipedia, Good Housekeeping. Really? There's a good article on Father's Day, Good Housekeeping. I was ready to be dazzled and amazed at this story, but much to my dismay, after reading entry after entry, I quickly realized I could keep this sermon really nice and short and boil Father's Day down to one simple and easy-to-remember nugget. Well, here it is. You might want to write this down. This is profound. There is Father's Day because there was Mother's Day. Let me repeat that. There is Father's Day because there was Mother's Day. That's about it, folks. The authors of the Father's Day article in History.com wrote, "The campaign to celebrate the nation's fathers did not meet with the same enthusiasm. Perhaps, as one florist put it, quote, fathers haven't the same sentimental appeal that mothers have." They also wrote that even when Father's Day was somewhat established on the national scene, quote, many men continued to disdain the day, and they scoffed at the holiday's sentimental attempts to domesticate manliness with flowers and gift-giving, while they derided the proliferation of such holidays as a commercial gimmick to sell more products, often paid for by the father himself. Father's Day had a tough beginning, for sure, and it seemed doomed to extinction for threatening, making dads seem, God forbid, sentimental, and threatening their manliness, whatever that means. But thank goodness someone saw the value in celebrating the contributions of fathers and kept the fight alive. Her name was, does anybody know her name? Come on, somebody. Well, I didn't either till yesterday, but last night. Sonora Smart Dodd is her name, who was so inspired by a Mother's Day service that she attended and the honor that it brought to moms that she wanted the same thing in honor of her own father, who was a two-time widower with 14 children. Woo! William Jackson Dodd. He raised those 14 children. Now, Sonora was a relentless pusher of this vision. She pushed her vision of Father's Day to the YMCA and to civic institutions, and luckily to the churches in and around Spokane, Washington, where she lived. And the churches loved the idea. They ate it up, and the Spokane Ministerial Association wanted to plan a celebration of fathers in churches all throughout Spokane. So Sonora pushed for June 5th for this celebration. That was her own dad's birthday, but there wasn't enough time to pull it off. It was too short, so this association of pastors and church leaders settled on the third Sunday in June, just as we have it today. The holiday began to spread to other states, and once World War II came along, it was pretty much ingrained in the nation's ethos. It wouldn't be until 1972 when Dick Nixon signed a congressional resolution declaring the third Sunday in June to be Father's Day. So yes, there is a little bit of history to this day we honor, but in the end, it still comes down to this one simple nugget. There is Father's Day because there was Mother's Day. But who cares? Happy Father's Day anyway, right? I know, much like Mother's Day, this day can elicit a range of emotions. I mean, that's why I've never really touched on it all that much for people based on their experiences with the father figures in their lives. I mean, let's be honest. Some experiences with fathers are warm and cozy, full of love and joy and fond memories. I'm lucky. Mine was that way. Some experiences may contain abuse and pain. Some are fearful with memories maybe of a domineering and rigid father experience. Some are just absent, lacking a father altogether who is not there for whatever reason. Some folks have two dads or no dads and two moms, while others have two dads and no mom. It's differences. Some were raised by single fathers and some by fathers who were rarely around and present in life. For some, not having kids raises emotions, and for some, like Fred Gutenberg, who I mentioned, losing kids brings up painful memories. I'm guessing we have a whole range of experiences right here in this sacred place, and I know that's why a lot of churches will not celebrate or honor Father's Day. I saw a bunch of that on Facebook this morning. Because of all those experiences, it can be hard and hurtful. And those churches that often do celebrate Father's Day, many all too often make the opposite mistake, and they make this day all about God, the ultimate father. And that can be almost just as harmful as the other stuff to folks and the baggage that we can carry in our lives. But we're going to talk about it anyways. Interestingly, our various experiences with fathers today are not so new, all the ones we have in this room, as our scriptures are full of stories, some good and some, well, not so good, to say the least. Some fathers out there, a couple not so good ones that stand out to me are one, Abraham. Remember Abraham? Who was, we are told, who heard a voice that told him to take his son and sacrifice him, to which he was about to do until an angel grabbed his knife-wielding hand and told him to sacrifice a ram instead. I would put that in a not-so-good experience with the father list. How about you? Not to mention the fact he kicked his other young son and mistress out in the wilderness with just a little bit of bread and water, maybe enough for a day or two. Definitely not in the running for Father of the Year. Or how about, in my opinion, the worst dad of the Bible? Oh, he's in there, all right. Lot. He's a real winner. Remember what he did? Two angels are traveling through Sodom in this story. It's a story. And they enter Lot's house, and a mob gathers to have these two men turned over to them. And Lot just kind of slides out the door real quick. He says, "Hey, look, fellas," and I'm quoting here, "I have two daughters who have never slept with a man. Let me bring them out to you, and you can do what you want with them." Whew. I think, like Abraham, he is also out of the running for Father of the Year. That just excludes you all the way. Now, these are just two examples of some pretty painful fathering experiences from the scriptures, and we could be here all day. There's quite a few others. But then there are stories, like the one Donna just read for us today. You know it as the prodigal son, though I'd like to change that today to biblical father of the year story. That's a better title for it, as I see it. And today I don't want to enter into some terrible theology mistakenly perpetuated about this story, like that this old man is God, and that God will welcome back the lost sinner and all that, or that this is somehow about the reconciliation of Christians and Jews. That's not what the story is about, but I'm not going to go theologically there today. I want to focus on the father. I just want to focus on the father today as a human being, as a dad, as a man that is raising two kids, could be more, we're not told in his actions towards them. Because I see in this story, though it is still shrouded in patriarchal language, I understand that, but I see in this story a new kind of love, a new kind of love from a father to his children, especially in light of all the other father experiences you read. Well, let me put it this way, when it comes to this story, in this cultural milieu of the patriarch, this story would almost always go very differently. It would go like this. This is how it would go in reality. A younger son whose only inheritance would be at the hands of his older brother, that's truth, the context, goes to his powerful father and asks for lands and riches so he can run off and revel and party, a grand act of disrespect that would not be tolerated. The father's anger over his egregious request boils over, and the father beats his younger son, disowns him, and casts him off the ancestral lands forever, forever, turning his and his community's backs against him. That's how the story would have really gone if Luke was sticking to the times. For younger sons did not have that kind of power, and even the thought, the mere thought of selling ancestral lands in a time when land was what truly kept you wealthy, well, that would be just something you would never, ever do. Land was everything. And he didn't just go off and run off and revel and give it all away or lose it. But this is a different kind of father here. And he not only, we are told, gives the younger son this inheritance, we are told he divides it then between both of them, right then and there. An odd thing to do when one is not even on their deathbed yet. So he is different. He's generous. That's what Luke is trying to say here. And we know this further because after the young son has run away, and after he's blown everything and he's working amongst the swine, you catch that little reference? A Jewish young man working amongst the swine? Well, when he concocts his plan to come back and to labor on his father's fields, he says, "How many of my father's hired hands have bread enough to spare? How many of my father's hired hands have bread enough to spare?" Saying, in effect, my father is a generous man with his wages, also a very uncommon thing amongst patriarchs. So the young man, destitute, broke, dirty, he begins his journey home after losing everything, including his family's ancestral lands. Again, I want to drive this home. Perhaps the worst thing you can do in squandering all his wealth, he goes back to the only place he feels like he can go, home. Home. I imagine him coming over the hillsides, his dirty clothes blowing in the wind, expecting the worst, to be met with anger, not just from his father, but from the community as well, as the land around them will now be changing hands to strangers. And as they will soon find out, Gentile strangers, the worst kind of neighbors, the worst kind of strangers in this context. In fact, this is so bad that there's a communal ritual to deal with losing lands. If a male ever loses lands to Gentiles, which that's what our young son did, when he dares to show his face again, the community would encircle him. This is a ritual. Fill a large ceremonial vase full of charred nuts and corn, and they smash it in front of him. They smash it in front of him, and they chant his name over and over again as they watch him walk away, and he's cut off from that community and his family forever. How serious it was. It's how serious it was. But he goes on anyway. He takes the chance, knowing this could be his context or his reality in this context. And we're told as he's walking, he's still far off. His father sees him. Like he's out watching every day. Every day he's out watching for him, waiting, hoping his baby, his son will come back home. That he might see him one more time, and he might get to him before he's cut off by the community. Remember, this is a different kind of father. We are told that this father he's filled with compassion when he does see him in the distance, and he runs to him, and he embraces him, and he kisses him, and he welcomes him home with a feast, the finest feast, and with new wealth and restored honor. And he doesn't ask any questions. He doesn't yell and get angry with him. He just loves him and rejoices that his dead son has now come back to life with him. And I bet he promised himself right then in that tender embrace just to never let him go again. Well, that is a Father of the Year candidate. Unless you are the other son. That's for another sermon, Wendy. Speaking of the older son, the father, though, is tender to him as well. The son expresses his anger at the feast thrown for his wayward brother. But his father says, "Son, you are always with me, and all that I have is also yours. But your brother was dead, and now he's come back, and we should not be angry at that, but we should celebrate that in the fullest." This is a generous man. That is the essence of what fatherhood should be at its best. May not always turn out that way. Doesn't always turn out that way. But this is the hope of fatherhood at its very best. I'd like to think that's how I would respond. If my youngest daughter asked for her inheritance and some of my lands, char immense, my wealth, so she could go off to L.A. and party and squander it all while my oldest daughter stays home and mows the lawn and does the chores. I'd like to think I'd always be out watching for her to come home, though, regardless of the choices that she made. I think that's how we all want to respond, right? And Jesus and Luke, they give us this parable to say, yes, yes, this is how you should respond. This is how you should live your life. Forgive radically, love fully, celebrate lavishly, show compassion rampantly, just like this old, nameless patriarch did when he shattered all expectations and usual ways of doing things long ago. I think this is a great scripture and story for the hope that is Father's Day, but I think it's also one for all of us to keep in mind. Luke wants us to understand that this is the kind of vision that Jesus lived and taught. And it overturns all boundaries. And it overturns and shatters all expectations. Do it this way, he is saying. He is saying, and you are on the right path. The one Jesus truly walked and calls us to. I love this story. I think this story is really the Bible at its best. Now, speaking of Father's Day, or fathers, father and daughter in this case, Mike and Sarah are going to sing a Bob Dylan classic song, "Blowing in the Wind," for us now. It seems such a fitting song to follow this story of a loving father because it essentially asks the same question. How often will we just continue to do the same old things before we decide to embrace a change for the good? We can begin to make that change any time. And it just took the story of an old, compassionate father with a big heart of love who breaks down walls and welcomes back a lost son today to teach us that. So wherever you stand on the fathering spectrum this day, whatever your father experiences were and are, may you find a sense of peace in this day, and especially in this story. So I wish you all a blessed Father's Day, my friends. Amen. Take us into the wind, Hagemans, with your amazing talent and voices.